Hi, this is Dr. David Stevens, your host on Christian Doctors Digest. Thanks for being with us. You know, we're facing a lot of challenges in our world. In fact, just yesterday, I was speaking at chapel to our staff, and I was speaking about time and used that verse in Ephesians 5, 15 through 16, where it says, "See then that ye walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time." Why? Because the days are evil. I probably don't have to convince you of that. You just need to watch the news and see what's happening every day around you. And we're facing lots of challenges for our families, for our marriages, for our practices, and many different spheres of life. That's why on this issue, we're going to focus on some of those evils and how we need to be dealing with those as wise Christians in the days ahead. First of all, we're going to talk about digital decisions for our children. Be talking to Dr. Charles Fay. How do we deal with the wealth of stuff that's on the internet to avoid the evil that is there with our own children and in our own lives? And then we're going to get to a couple of the big issues of the day. We're going to be talking to Dr. Alan Josephson about the transgender issue, which has hit the forefront in just this last year, with new regulations coming down from the federal government that's going to affect your practice and every healthcare professional in this country. Dr. Josephson is going to help us understand this issue. And then Dr. Al Mohler from Southern Baptist Seminary is going to be talking about right of conscience and how we approach that whole issue and apply it to all the different areas of our lives and practice where it's so important. We've got a wealth of information you're going to get. Let's get to our first guest. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Charles Fay to the microphone. Charles is a PhD, graduated in 1997 with high honors from the University of South Carolina. Prior to and during his university training in school and clinical psychology, he enjoyed extensive experience working with children in psychiatric, public school, mental health settings. Currently, he's a full-time author, consultant, public speaker, and the CEO of the Love and Logic Institute. He's got a great sense of humor, a wonderful ability to tell stories and relate to audiences of all ages. He's got some powerful information that's going to help you not only in this area, but if you go to the Love and Logic Institute and a lot of areas of family life. But today we're going to be talking about making good digital decisions for your children. Charles, it's so good to have you with us on Christian Doctors Digest, talking about a topic that all of us are concerned about, but you don't read that much about, talking to your children about technology and how to deal with it in a family. But before we do that, let's just step back just a little bit. Tell me more about your organization, Love and Logic. I want our members to be familiar with it.
Well, I was raised with Love and Logic. That's right. I am a psychologist, but my dad, Jim Fay, and his great friend, Dr. Foster Klein, started working in the 1970s, really trying to help parents who were struggling with how to set limits and how to discipline their kids in ways where they wouldn't lose the kids' love and respect. And that became a passion, and because I love my dad, and we've had such a good relationship, we've been able to work together all these years.
Tell me some of the principles that Love and Logic teaches about when you're dealing with kids and how to develop that respect and relationship where you're really building yourselves into their lives and teaching them how to make good decisions.
That's right. Well, we often talk about it in terms of the three E's of Love and Logic. And these are the ways that kids learn in the most powerful manner. And the first E is the hard one for us parents, and that is example, setting a good example for our kids. The second E is the one that isn't as natural for a lot of parents, and that is experience. And more specifically, we hope and pray. We pray every day that our kids and all the kids that we know make lots of mistakes. When the price tag is small, so that they can experience affordable consequences and develop a good understanding of cause and effect. Now, the third E is empathy. That's sincere empathy. That doesn't mean bailing the kids out or being permissive, but it means demonstrating a tremendous amount of unconditional love and care for the kid as they are experiencing the full brunt of the consequences of their choices.
Well, and learning them to make small mistakes and how to solve them teaches you later on how to make better decisions when bigger issues are on the table.
Yeah, and one of the beautiful blessings we have is the freedom to make some mistakes. And what we want parents to understand is that, of course, when the big stuff comes along, we step in and we rescue or protect. But most of the time, we're allowing kids to, you know, maybe buy something with their own money that's going to break right away, or maybe we're going to allow them, and this is hard for parents, allow them to not do their homework and then experience the consequence of getting a poor grade and, boy, far better in the fifth grade than when they're out in college or out in the professional world.
Yeah, and some parents have never done that. I have a whole family that's taught school, and I can remember my brother-in-law, who's a college professor, just retired, and saying, you know, parents calling up and saying, you know, what does my child have to do to get an A when they've already failed the class? And you think, oh, my, these helicopter parents, we can overprotect our kids. And if you don't let them make mistakes, you'll end up paying the consequences as life goes on.
Yeah, the irony, Dave, is that when we overprotect, we actually make it more likely that our kids are going to make some decisions that may tragically end their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's get into the technology issue. And, of course, it's all over the place, isn't it?
Right. Oh, it's a huge issue. And I want to say to parents and professionals, we know you love your kids. We wouldn't be listening to this if you didn't love them. And I want to encourage you to be heavily involved in their lives and to say to yourself, my job as a parent and my job as a professional as well is to encourage parents to be involved in their kids and not worry about invading the kids' privacy.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know what's going on in our kids' lives. And we've seen a trend in America where many parents are afraid to, you know, find out what the kid is doing in their room, or afraid to be nosy. And you know what that really says to kids, even though they protest? You know, I love you enough to really be involved in your life. So step number one, don't hesitate to invade their privacy. And we are advocates of having different types of software where you can really have a little better sense of what's going on in the kid's life. Doesn't mean they can't find ways around it. But the key is the message. The message is, son, daughter, love you so dearly, you're the apple of my eye. And sure, you could probably find some ways to get sneaky and do things behind my back, but you know, I love you enough. I love you so much that I'm going to be as involved as possible in your life. And that's really the message that needs to get sent.
Yeah, and love is really the key. You know, we think about the internet, and we'll get into that, and pornography and things, but I mean, technology is more than that. It's TV. You can spend too much time on that. It's video games. It's your phone. It's your MP3 player. I mean, it's just continual input from electronic sources, and it can consume even before you get to the bigger issues of bullying and pornography and all the rest of it. Kids can just spend too much time in a fantasy world.
Right, and we as parents, we need to set limits. And healthcare providers, here you can teach parents a simple strategy for setting limits, and it goes like this: try not to tell the kid what to do. Mostly focus on telling them what you're going to do or allow. So instead of me saying, hey, you know, son, you better not spend too much time on the internet, you know, I honestly really can't enforce it. But what I can enforce is this: son, I allow electronics in this home as long as they don't interfere with our loving relationship. And honestly, when I ask you to shut your phone off and you say things like, fine, you know, or you refuse to do that, that interferes with our relationship in a very serious way. And so I may reluctantly have to remove those things. So, son, let me be clear here that I want you to be able to have those things, but at the same time, our relationship is more important. And so it's describing what I'm going to allow and only setting limits over things I can control, which is what I provide.
Yeah, because oftentimes when you approach it the wrong way, you lose control. Beyond your power limit, and then you lose respect as well.
Yeah, the goal is really to make it so that our word, when we say yes, it means yes, and no means no, and done in a loving way. And the best way that happens is when we're focusing on what we do. We can control that.
Yeah. But when it becomes a problem, then we're going to deal with it. And who decides who decides that it's going to be a problem?
The person in the home with the most maturity.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is hopefully the adult.
Yeah, hopefully mom and dad. So
yeah, we get to decide. And sometimes, quite frankly, it's kind of a gut level thing where, you know, too many times parents, they're worried about doing something or enforcing a limit until they know for sure.
Yeah.
And we believe that as soon as we start feeling like there's a relationship problem and that's becoming an idol for the kid, you know, that's all they care about, that's when we just need to trust our intuition and trust the Holy Spirit and step in there and say, this is a problem, and we're gonna reel this in a bit.
Well, you know, one of the things I know you emphasize is trying to help the child come up with a plan to solve the problem before, I mean, you've got accountability there, and there's going to be a place where you need to step in. But an earlier step is really teaching them to make better decisions and helping them do it. Describe how you go through that process. I think that was so valuable when I was listening to some of your materials.
One of the most important things we can do as parents is to have some conversations with our kids where we ask questions and we get them just talking about what they think about what other kids might do. And I like to make it about other kids because it's safer.
Mm-hmm.
So I might say to my son, Cody, who's 9, I say, hey, Cody, have you ever heard of some other kids really getting in trouble on the internet doing things that they shouldn't? You know, what do you think? And, well, you know, I know some kids do such and such. And we have a conversation about that.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is it opens up the lines of communication, and it starts us being able to talk about a little bit about cause and effect. Well, gosh, some kids decide that they're going to look at some things, you know, like pornography that really is just not good for them, and it really hurts the people, other people that are involved in it. And what they find out is that they start having a harder time making good decisions, and you know, really their heart kind of goes in a place that isn't good, and they don't even feel good about it. Then they're hooked, you know. And we have those little conversations, you know, about other people, mm-hmm. about other kids, and that's a real safe way to start moving into it. And you know, one of the things we do see is that sometimes, you know, really good parents are really uncomfortable talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly of the internet. And, of course, we need to do it in a developmentally appropriate way, but far better that they start talking about it with us than discovering it with their friends or on their own. So that's really the first step.
Or what's being taught in the sex ed class at school.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, how do you get them to help make a plan? I mean, now that you've got the topic raised and they're understanding their issues, how do you help them to begin put together a plan of how they're going to deal with this?
Right. And so I'll ask the kid, again, the highly successful people are constantly asking questions. Instead of saying what the person should believe, I'm constantly asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
So, son, we're really wanting you to be able to have this computer and be able to use it in our home. And so what do you think you might do if you are, you know, you Google something for school and then up pops something that you're thinking, wow, you know, that's not what I should be looking at. What's your plan?
Mm-hmm.
And see if kids say, well, I just won't look at it, and it's kind of short, their response, it probably means they're not ready.
Yeah.
If they can say things like, well, you know, I'm going to, you know, I have this piece of scripture that I've really, that I buried in my heart, you know, I've hid in my heart, and it goes, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And I think that I'm going to say that to myself, and I'm going to come and talk to you about it. So I'm not, you know, then maybe there's a little bit higher chance that I can trust that this kid is really going to have the skills to be able to handle the situation. And so I'm really going for specificity in the plan, and I'm also going for this, and that is that, son, do you suppose that any people ever blow it? Good people, they blow it, and they look at something they shouldn't look at, or they do something online that they shouldn't do. And do you think that they ever hold that in and not talk to people about it? And do you ever think that maybe that just gets bigger and bigger for them, and they have a harder time resisting it because they're so afraid to talk to somebody about it? Well, son, I want you to know that there's nothing that can separate, you know, us from each other. My love, you know, for you is unconditional. And so if you ever feel like you need to talk about something, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put my arm around you, and I'm going to say, thank you so much for telling me about that. What's your plan for the future?
Yeah.
You know, and because we have to make it really safe for when a kid has fallen, for them to come and be like, you know, the father of the prodigal son and run to the kid.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Say, I love you.
Yeah. 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 And accept them, gave him the biggest banquet he had ever had and the nicest clothes he ever wore.
Yeah.
And used it as a teaching moment.
Yeah. I love you. And that, it's that grace that is really going to draw the kid to us. And we want to give them a picture of the Heavenly Father, of course, so that as imperfect as our picture is, at least they have a bit of a template that makes it easier for them to trust God.
Charles, if, you know, they do blow it and they come to you, I know, especially, you know, you can be shocked with what's happened or you find out about. How are some of the ways to do that rightly, you know, and the emotion, especially when the emotions are running high? I can't believe you did that, you know. And it may be not just technology. It could be other things. You know, they've wrecked the car, or they, you know, drive without a driver's license or whatever it may be. You had some good advice in the CD I listened to. There's a time to pause.
Oh, yeah, there's a time to pause. And if your kid comes to you and says such and such, or you find out about it.
Yeah.
The first response for most of us is not, oh, how can I deliver this with great grace and empathy? Most of us, quite frankly, have this moment of where we feel like we just want to freak out.
Yeah.
Or maybe we're just really angry, or we're really scared and that comes out as anger. And so sometimes it's best to go to the kid and say, I am so upset right now that I can't think straight. I just make such better decisions when I'm calm. I'm so thankful for you. It'll never change. But right now I'm really mad, and I just need to take some time to calm down. We'll talk about this later.
Yeah.
And then come back to the kid when you're calm. Now let's be clear, and I want to make sure I represent Love and Logic correctly. We're going to handle it with great grace and empathy, but it doesn't mean that there might not be some consequences. So maybe I have a kid who comes to me and they admit they've got a problem with pornography, or they're gambling on the internet or something other, anything, and or I find out about it. There's going to be empathy when I'm calmed down, but it's going to sound something like this. Oh, sweetheart, I'm so thankful that I have you, and I'm thankful that we found out about this, you know, when we did, okay, and I just love you. And I imagine this is kind of scary for you right now. So one of the things that I feel like I need to do to help is at least right now make sure that there's not temptation, at least in our home,
mm-hmm.
until we can get this thing sorted out. Well, does that mean you're going to take my phone? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, I need my computer for school. I know, honey. Now, some kids decide to go to school and ask the teacher how they might be able to complete the assignment without using their computer. And so there's going to be some fairly significant boundaries and consequences, but they're all designed to help this kid grow into a healthy, responsible person, not to make him feel bad, right?
Well, and then you want to plan. I remember you saying you want to plan to now how are we going to prevent this in the future when you start, you know, saying, okay, maybe we can have the computer back, but what's the plan and how are we going to make sure this doesn't happen again? Help them get to think it through.
That's right. I'd like to circle around to something and just so I feel like I get this on my chest. And there's a lot of teenagers that are actually saying, you know, I wish that my parents would put their technology down for a while and spend time with me. And isn't that a twist on this? And then that's pretty convicting for a lot of us, including myself, where there are times where I am so tempted. I'm at the Little League game, and I'm so tempted to look at my phone, and here I have this boy who's nine who will never be nine again. And I'm tempted to look at my phone instead of him. Now, I'm admitting this, so it's something that we all, I think, struggle with in this day and age. What are our priorities?
Yeah, and not only with our kids, but with our spouse. I mean, you go home, start working, and she says it three times, and you still haven't heard us come to supper, you know? So I'm confessing my guilt as well.
we all struggle with this. And it's part of our culture right now, but we can overcome this. And a big part of it is, quite frankly, saying to ourselves, we're going to be countercultural. And when I was a kid, countercultural meant you drove a Volkswagen bus and you had really long hair and listened to rock music. Now it means that, you know, you're saying to your kids, yeah, probably a good idea to shut that off now.
Yeah.
We're going to go a weekend without doing this stuff. That's countercultural.
Right. Let's take a technology-free day and just be together as a family. You talked a little bit about accountability. I want to circle around back to that. You know, we have a responsibility as parents, as our children are going through this, to hold them accountable, and you believe in putting some monitoring software on their electronics and keeping track of things.
I do. And now the problem with monitoring software is that it cannot parent.
Right.
And there's a temptation sometimes when we're as parents where we'll put a monitoring software or some sort of parental controls on a computer, and then we think, oh, good, you know, we're good to go here. It's never going to parent for us, and we're never going to be able to ensure that our kids are not doing some things behind our back. But the whole focus of it is, again, the message that it sends the kid, I care enough to be involved in your life. And Chip Stearns in Silicon Valley, he came to me one time and said, hey, I'm designing this software, and I kind of ran the other way because I tend to do that when people come to me and tell me things like that. But as I got to know the guy, I started realizing that it's good stuff. It's called iDactic, and listeners can just Google that, iDactic. And it's a parental involvement software. And what Chip said to me, he said, I'm not going to release this unless I am able to provide parents with how to use it correctly, because you can't parent the kid, and they're going to need to know how to handle it when they find out either the kid's being sneaky or the kid says, well, you can't put that on my computer, that sort of thing. And so that's how we came to develop our audio called Real Talk on Technology. And that's how it all came about. Because he said this is mostly about parenting. So, yes, the software is a good thing.
We could go into so many more topics, cyberbullying and all the rest of it, but you've covered a lot of that in the resources we're going to mention in Real Talk About Technology. It's a wonderful CD. I've just spent the afternoon, a couple hours listening to it, and wish I'd had it 15, 20 years ago when my kids were younger. But you guys got a wealth of resources on a lot of topics beyond this and the Love and Logic magazine and library, and some of it's online, some of it you can order. So I just want to thank you, Charles, for what you've done for and your dad, and going back a generation here for families across the U.S., just lots of practical materials that we can use in our own families and can recommend to others who are struggling with these issues, because we see them in our offices every day. As parents bring in their kids, it doesn't take you long to realize whether they're treating their parents with respect or not, and how things are going in the family. You know that when they come in to see you. So we need to be pouring oil on the waters and giving people tools to help them have healthy families. Thank you for what you're doing.
And thank you for having me. And I want to encourage everybody out there. Yeah, you can make a big difference. And parents, just so thankful for the help.
Well, I encourage you to check out loveandlogic.com for more information. And hopefully this information is going to be helpful not only to you, but through you to many of your patients. We've got a great resource here at CMDA that you can order from our Life and Health Resources as well, called Hot Buttons, the Internet Edition by Nicole Odell. Just a small booklet that gives information on top of even what Dr. Fay said. It's available at 888-230-2637. One of our staff would be happy to help you, or go on cmda.org and go to our resource area, and you can order your copy today. Welcome to another TaxWise Moment. It's great to have Jamie Campbell, our Vice President of Stewardship, with us. Jamie, today we're going to talk about life insurance. What do people need to know?
Well, I know it's everyone's favorite subject, but wanted to talk about it because it's sometimes pretty misunderstood. The definition of life insurance simply is something that protects those who depend on your paycheck. If you die prematurely, life insurance provides your dependents with ongoing income to replace your income. One thing that life insurance is not, typically, is the best vehicle for estate planning purposes. You don't necessarily want to have a life insurance policy just to leave an inheritance. It's really an income replacement vehicle, not an inheritance vehicle.
Now, what do you mean by that? In other words, there's better ways to invest that money if you don't need it to provide income for your family if you die prematurely.
That's true. This is particularly important if you have a young family. Maybe your spouse stays at home and takes care of the children. You have to think about living expenses, educational expenses, those sorts of things for a number of years down the road. So when you're young, it's probably the time in your life when you need the most insurance. And the good part of that is it's probably the time of your life when it's going to be the cheapest insurance you can ever buy.
So how does that change as time goes by?
Your needs will likely change as your children get older and become more independent and those kinds of things, and the need for life insurance may reduce. It may go away.
And your income increases and you have more investments and other things to take care of your family.
Right. And as you get older and your family matures, life insurance may not be the best place to invest your money long term.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have the biggest responsibilities and you have more money in your investments to take care of your spouse, for example, if you die first. And as men know, that's usually the case. We go first.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What about whole life versus other forms of insurance?
Well, there's a couple of different kinds of life insurance. Whole life or cash value insurance that typically covers your whole life, hence the term. Or there's term life. It's insurance that you buy that lasts a term of your life, maybe 10, 15, 20 years. Our friend Dave Ramsey recommends avoiding whole life or cash value insurance altogether. And I think that's typically pretty good advice. The key to life insurance is taking time to review it occasionally so you can adjust your coverage as it's needed. As we talked earlier, as you get older, your life insurance needs probably will decrease, but your situation could change. You may have a spouse or a child who develops a chronic condition that may need care the rest of their life, and life insurance is a way that you can provide for that.
Why would Dave Ramsey say that whole life is not something you should probably go after?
Well, because of the fact that you probably don't need life insurance your entire life.
Right.
So don't lock into that for the next 50, 60, 70 years when you really just need it maybe for 20 or 25 years.
So let's say like what happened to me, Northwest Mutual came to medical school, sold me a whole life policy. What should I be doing with that now if I still owned it?
Well, that's a perfect example of what we hear from members on a pretty regular basis. Somebody's come along in medical school or residency or early in their practice and sold them a whole life policy and said, you know, this is the answer to all your financial problems is to buy life insurance. And we have a lot of members who have those policies that are paid up, typically, the whole life insurance. The income is covering the premium, so they're not having to pay those, and they're just sitting around, and a lot of folks forget about those. One thing you can do with those kinds of policies, if they're not needed, is make it a gift to charity.
How does that work? I mean, if I gave a life insurance policy to my church or to CMDA or another organization that I support, what does that do for them? What's it do for me?
Well, you can transfer complete ownership to the charity, to your church, to CMDA, to any other organization, nonprofit that you may support. It's an irrevocable gift. And that makes the owner of that policy, CMDA, your church, the beneficiary of it at your death. Mm-hmm. It costs you nothing up front. There may be a tax deduction for you depending on the value of the policy at the time of the transfer. You don't need it, and the charity benefits at your death.
So it's another way that you can be a good steward, especially if that money is really not needed for another purpose at your death.
It is. And another way you can do that, instead of making total transfer of the life insurance policy, is you can simply name the charity as the primary or contingency beneficiary of the policy. That way they benefit from it at your death, but you still remain in control of it. And if you have premiums that you're having to pay and those kinds of things, that just continues.
One other thing that I came aware of just recently, you can put in your will to give a certain amount of your retirement account mm-hmm. to a charity, but that is actually, or a trust, a living trust, that doesn't make it happen unless you have done that as the beneficiary of their retirement account. And I had a good friend that just found that out with his mother. And she had said, oh, yeah, I want some of this money to go to this charity, that charity. Mm-mm, had to go to the kids because they were the beneficiaries in the retirement plan. That's something I didn't realize.
Yeah, you may say you want this to happen, but what's on paper is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So you want to be sure that's done. And a retirement account is a great way to give to charity because there's no tax in that transaction, but there may very well be a tax situation with your children.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. They've got to put it in their retirement account or take it all out in blocks. So, yeah, good idea because it was in her trust, but the trust was trumped by the fact of what it said on the retirement account beneficiaries. Jamie, it's just always good to have you on, and you've given us some great information to help us be good stewards. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Dave.
It's a real privilege to have Dr. Alan Josephson at our microphone. He has a very distinguished career as well as being a longtime member of CMDA. He is professor in chief of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Louisville. He's also chief executive officer of the Bingham Clinic in Louisville, Kentucky. His professional interest has been in family problems and their relation to the psychiatric disorders of children and adolescents. And in that capacity, he's been the lead author of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Practice Parameters on the Assessment of the Family. He's recognized nationally, internationally for not only this, but his work in religion, spirituality, and psychiatry. And he recently received the Oscar Feister Award from the American Psychiatric Association, which is given to an individual for significant achievement in the study of psychiatry and religion. He's going to be talking to us about the transgender issue and has a lot of wonderful insights. It's a joy to have this kind of expertise at our microphone. Alan, it's great to have you with us. This issue we're going to talk about today is one that has just kind of leapt in the forefront of what's happening in our country. The whole transgender issue, it seems like, you know, same-sex marriage was legalized, then all of a sudden this cascade of information and regulations and other things come down. Help us to understand this issue. You deal with adolescent patients all the time and children. Explain to us how you approach the transgender issue, how you understand it. Then we'll get into what we need to be doing and saying about it.
Sure. Well, I want to make a couple of opening remarks related to that, the speed with which this has taken place. In my experience, just in the last couple of years, it's been stunning in its power. I had a pediatric resident with me about a year back and was telling me that there were those in pediatrics, a minor group but very real, who said it was an act of supreme bias to label an infant, male or female, in the nursery.
Oh, my.
And I couldn't believe what he or she was saying. And then I got an application from one of our professional organizations, and it asked about gender, and it said male, female, and had a couple other things. And it said current gender. A friend of mine had sent this, and he underlined with exclamation mark, current. It's hard to believe, but these people are serious, that gender is that fluid and that arbitrary in human terms. The issue itself has been around for a long time. Probably the most firm scientific basis is that the term intersex, in which some children with things like congenital adrenal hyperplasia have ambiguous sex organs. So there have been cases of boys being raised as girls and vice versa, and it's a biological disorder disease. There certainly have been transgender kids, and that means boys who feel inside that they're a girl and vice versa for some period of time as well, and those have been in a distinct minority. But it really seems to be growing in its frequency, and it's being identified, and it's becoming a huge, huge problem.
Do you think it's also being promoted? I mean, the more we're talking about this, it seems like their numbers are growing, and there are actually websites that cater to this and support it, and we're seeing, you know, the demand in some of our professional organizations as well as from the government that we validate it as just a normal variant. You know, you're talking about labeling on applications. I just picked up an article yesterday, and a court judge in Oregon declared a woman was not male or female. She was binary. A term I'd never heard before.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. You can get intimidated by different labels, and as physicians, we all like to know things and have studied up on it. But Paul McHugh, who I think is one of the most articulate persons on this and has studied this for 30 years, psychiatrist, former chair at Hopkins, he has said, you know, there's one website that has identified there are now 58 genders.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, it just is so, in some ways, anti-intellectual and anti-common sense that it blows one away. But to get back to your point, Dave, I think it is true that when the media pursue this and push this, it pushes us into the realm of normal. Mm-hmm. So when Bruce Jenner has a standing ovation at the ESPY Awards, or the stars of this program, the Orange is the New Black, and they're given ovations, it has become then a cultural phenomenon. So I like to break it down as there's the intersex, the biological deviation, the then those with clear psychological family problems, and then this new group, which I call the cultural chic, if you will. It's kind of trendy, and this is very dangerous because, particularly with young people, you're playing with fire here. This is not a disorder to pursue and be seen as normal.
And it helps understand the basis of it. Family, social, environment, biological. How do you look at this?
As I said, with the serious biological intersex, that can be kind of dismissed because it's so rare. In actual fact, the numbers are hard to find, but these are rough approximations. Birth females believing that they're males, that's about 2 per 100,000 individuals. Males who believe they are females, 5 per 100,000. So it's still an extremely rare kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But when you get into the psychology, it is a solution for some individuals to their many problems. And I think Paul McHugh, again, says it best when he says the avoidance of the assumed demands of that sex is what motivates many of these people. So simply put, young men are blown away by the prospects of what's involved with being young men. And it's almost as the mind works, well, this will protect me from that. I recently had a case of and this will illustrate this point, young girl said, you know, she was really a man, a boy. And as I got the family history, horrific kind of abuse and dysfunctional family, and she had kind of determined, if I am a man, I will not be subject to the violence and abuse that my mother had received. And she was pretty much laying it out in that way. So this idea has a protective function. Now, one of the key issues here, and a major, major problem, is that it is being pushed as a civil right that we're defending rather than a disorder needing treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very, as I'm sure you know, a very big distinction. So these people need help. And they need treatment. Now, the difference between this disorder and straightforward, if you will, homosexuality, is that this remains a disorder. It's in our manual. It's in the statistical and diagnostic manual for psychiatry. Therefore, needs treatment. Now, most of the treatment that's being pushed these days is to facilitate biological change through hormonal modification of adolescence and ultimately surgical modification of adults. Many thoughtful people are calling that child abuse, and we have not heard the end of it because it is so so dramatic in its presentation.
So how do you approach this as a psychiatrist? I mean, you've given this example of the girl, but I know you've taken care of many patients. Because, I mean, there's efforts underway to even ban treatment for this.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Unbelievable. And Paul McHugh, you talk about him, he has so many insights, and he says this is like having a girl that's anorexic and thinks she's fat when she's thin, and so we say, well, we'll offer you liposuction.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're doing in healthcare, but some people are pushing. Yeah.
Perfect example, right. And there's other literature emerging, and I've actually been intrigued by this and kind of like it, is that it is a delusion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many of us have seen anorexia nervosa patients who are deluded. And the definition of the disorder is you're thin on the verge of death and you believe you're fat. That is a false fixed belief, and that's a delusion. And this one, obviously, is clearly there. And to get others to line up and believe something that's blatantly not true but is false is even worse. And then if a governmental influence comes in and says, you can't talk about this. I mean, it's you know, it's thought control of the highest order. And of course, we see that throughout our culture in many other ways. But that is of concern, because then these individuals who need help and families who need help will not get it. And the other thing where families come in is very difficult for them with this onslaught of the media message, because what do we hear that these young people need to get and need to hear? They need affirmation. You know, I just cringe every time I hear that, because no, they need the truth. And we should stop, and I know you've covered this in other areas of medicine and your work there, but we start with compassion and Christian love.
Mm-hmm.
You're concerned for this person. And then you have the sensitivity to say, but you've got to look at this other direction. Let's look at that. And if I could sound like a preacher for a minute, I'm a preacher's kid, so here goes. But
we share that in common.
Yeah, no, hey, one of the gifts of that it was given to me, for
yes.
Sure. So in John 8, the woman who's caught in adultery is brought before Jesus. And whoever is without sin casts the first stone. And people say, well, now that you put it that way, I guess we don't have much to say. And they all kind of filter away.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus says, woman, who has condemned you? And Jesus says, well, no one. Neither do I. Now, I think we always forget that last verse.
Yeah.
Neither do I, but then he offers a clear directive. So I think that's a model for so many of these dilemmas as Christian healthcare professionals, to say, we love you, God loves you, but there's a better way, and you know it, and let's try to help you follow that. So I think those are some kind of principles that I use, and I think that we need to keep in mind when we're working with this. I want to just share one other thing, Dave. You know, I believe that part of the thing that drew me into psychiatry, it gave me the luxury of kind of looking at the big picture of things. These days, we're using medicine for everything and not solving half the problems that way. It takes that away from us, but I'm a little bit of a cultural philosopher, if you will, and there's massive confusion out there about we need to tolerate the person, we need to respect the person, but we do not need to tolerate the idea.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we shouldn't. So it was, I think it was Voltaire who was originally attributed to this, you know, I disagree with what you're saying, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. And I think We need to love the person, but say, no, I don't think, like in this case, this is not healthy. This is not going to work for you. And ultimately, the same thing works with or can be used for the homosexuality issue as we try to find a compassionate way to address that.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And, you know, it reminds me of what's going on in the culture is kind of the Hans Christian Andersen story of the emperor in his new clothes. You know, he thought he was wearing these clothes and everybody, he was beautiful, but nobody else could see it because they were crude and common. And all the people stood on the side of the road and cheered because they were afraid of what would happen to them if they didn't. And that is an analogy of what, unfortunately, we're seeing in our culture, because anybody that disagrees then obviously hates these people, which is absolutely wrong. You want what's best for these people.
Yes.
And living in this delusional state is not a good state to be in because of suicide, depression, the consequences of their sexual promiscuity, all sorts of things that come out that are very clear that this is not a healthy lifestyle, and saying it's okay and going to make it better.
Yeah. No, and I think we can get intimidated, and we need to push back in Christian love with all the vigor of the strength of our community, the strength of Scripture, the strength of knowing science as best we can, and do so. And I think you've been a wonderful example, and as the organization has moved, with testifying in D.C. and trying to get in front of our secular world the truth. But I read a quote?
Sure.
Brought along from Paul McHugh again. So he says, "But gird your loins if you would confront this matter. Hell hath no fury like a vested interest masquerading as a moral principle." And I think that really sums up all of the various sexual issues, that if we begin to say, this is not how we're made, we're in an intended world, we're not in an accidental world, and this is how God wants it to be, we need to be ready for the fury that results. Now, because we have the truth, and Jesus is the truth, that's not a problem. But in human terms, we all know what that means. I was stunned as I was doing a little preparation for our chat today. By the way, I looked at the transgender identification statement, CMJ, that just got approved, I guess, just recently.
Yes.
Very nice. I really liked it, and I would encourage all members to take a look at it. But in the references, very nicely referenced piece of work, Ken Zucker from Toronto, a longtime developmental psychologist who is right along with Paul McHugh, is knowing the most about this problem, I was stunned to realize his gender clinic was closed in Toronto fairly recently. And the reason it was closed is for the very issue that we're considering here, Dave, that all he was doing was with these broken people, and that's a good phrase to use, broken, hurting people, trying to sort through putting them back together again, and the word was, you can't do this. You can't do this. So that's a discouraging thing sometime, but...
And they not only destroyed, you know, shut his clinic, they destroyed his reputation. I mean, they went after him.
So you may know more about it than I.
All teeth barred, and tried to discredit him, you know, in every aspect of his life. We're seeing this, and you know, that came out of, unfortunately, the Homosexual Manifesto back in the 80s, that, you know, you discredit anyone that disagrees with you, you attack them, and you try to destroy them. And that now spilling over into this issue as well. And I think one of the things we're going to face is realizing that is going to be tried and sometimes accomplished. And secondly, still love these people that are trying to do this to us. But it's challenging days in healthcare. But I just always have to remember, Alan, God could have created us at any time, and he created us for this time.
Yes.
That's what we're responsible for. And he never promised it was going to be easy. He promised he was going to be faithful.
There's another idea. I think this idea of confusing civil rights with treatment.
Mm-hmm.
The minute people start using discrimination, you get in trouble. You know, if you think of the word discrimination, it's an emotionally loaded term. And if we think of it in emotional terms, we can't support discrimination anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of the term further, it can be used in a cognitive way, you know, as in he or she is a discriminating buyer or discriminating shopper.
Mm-hmm.
And if you use it in that time, like sorting through ideas, we must be discriminating. Some ideas are better than others. The minute, though, these intellectual discriminating ideas gets pushed into, like you said, you're a hateful person, you hate homosexual individuals, they've won the battle. And that's something that we want to be pushed back against. Have you seen Al Mohler's new book, We Cannot Be Silent? what made me think about that, he begins it with a line from Flannery O'Connor that we must push back against the age with all our might. Came from one of his essays. And then he talks about how we need to push back, to be strong, not offensive, but to push back. And I think what you've done with so much of your work and giving the clear message that we must be visible in our secular culture, because if we're not, you know, the secularists aren't sitting there, you know, I wonder what the Christians think about
things. Yeah.
No, and I think that's a very important message for us as believers, and probably was an idea that really led me to spend my work in the secular world, kind of being a secular missionary, so to speak, is how I've seen my work, because you would have no idea what goes on out here unless you fight in that, and to push back with love and grace, you know.
Yeah, and we as healthcare professionals are on the ideal platform to do it that many people
yep.
don't have. I mean, they're going to be discredited just being as you're homophobic, you're transgenderphobic, you're whatever, but we can speak the facts and the truth in love and demonstrate through our actions that we genuinely care for people.
Yep.
And,
yep.
You know, I think that's an ideal place God has put us in this day and time to make a difference.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And I think one of the things that's helped me doing some of this work is, you know, thoughtful Christian colleagues who, I guess the true meaning of the word fellowship. You know,
mm-hmm.
you think through things, you pray through things, you strategize, and through the good humor of seeing the goodness in our world, you can get through this. But I've always liked the phrase, truth is not decided by show of hands.
Yeah.
It is what it is. And you can act like Eastern European universities used to act, and people can't think that, and so much of it is going on now in our country, but the truth still remains there. And if you try to redefine sexuality, redefine human nature, it will not change. I like the comparison. If you don't believe in the law of gravity, that's fine, but jump out of a window and it will quickly assert itself, and you will understand its consequences. And so much of this is, if you say a man is a woman, you can believe that, but the false nature of that will quickly assert itself.
Well, Alan, it's good you know you're part of our psychiatric section, and there's other psychiatrists who share your concerns and are willing to try to deal with this. And I think you being able to kind of wrap this up and hand it to us so we can understand the issue better, and then we've got some good resources here at CMDA to help our members. This is new ground for many of us, but we must walk it, and we must talk it, and we must be that voice of righteousness in our culture. So I want to thank you for what you're doing, and we're going to have you back on, because I think we're going to continue to have issues like this, unfortunately.
Thanks for the opportunity, Dave, and God's blessing on your work. Thanks.
First, let me apologize for all the scratchiness of that interview. We had problems with the phone lines, but I think you could hear the core of what we were trying to communicate, and that's why we went ahead and put this on, Christian Doctors Digest. Now, let me tell you where there's another great resource. If you haven't seen it already, it should be part of your library. It's CMDA's new Transgender Identification Ethics Statement, which was put together by our Ethics Committee last year and approved at the CMDA national meeting by the board and then by the House of Representatives. Actually, a unanimous vote from the House. It's rich information with lots of references, tells you not only how to understand this issue, but how do we approach it as Christians. And in two pages, you're going to have a wealth of information. To get that, go to cmda.org, go to resources, or just search for our ethics statements, and it will give you the information you need. And I think it'll be very helpful to you, and feel free to pass it on to others. Couple CMDA updates. If you haven't been to a marriage enrichment weekend, you've missed out. You know, this isn't because you have a lot of problems in your marriage. It's because, like exercising, you want to keep healthy. You want to not only keep healthy physically, but in your relationship with your spouse. Two great events coming up, both of them in Sonoma, California, February 3rd through the 5th, 2017. And then again, March 24th through the 26th, 2017. And that one is specifically for female physicians and their spouses. Check those out at cmda.org, and you can register online. And then don't forget, the national meeting's coming up May 4th through the 7th. At CMDA's National Convention will once again be in beautiful North Carolina up in the mountains. The theme is Transforming Lives. We've got a great lineup of speakers and wonderful worship music. In fact, Stephanie Seafelt, who did our worship music last year, is going to be back. She is one of the most talented musicians I've ever seen. I spoke last year, and afterwards she did the closing song, and she had written the song about my message while I was preaching, and I was blown away. She did that with every speaker, and just a wonderful person who will lead us in worship and also entertain us on Saturday night. So a great time in store. Check it out. Bring the family. Bring a friend. Even maybe take a medical student or a resident with you and invest in their lives and let them get exposed to a wonderful time of ministry, fellowship, and networking. Hope to see you there. What a treat it is to welcome Dr. Al Mohler to our microphone. I met Al when I was up in Louisville. He actually spoke to our CMDA student and graduate groups there. He's the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, which is the flagship school of the Southern Baptist Conventions and one of the largest seminaries in the world. Dr. Mohler has a long history and many degrees. He has a Master of Divinity degree as well as a Doctor of Philosophy degree from Southern Seminary. He's also had additional study at St. Menard School of Theology and the University of Oxford in England. He's a theologian. He's an ordained minister. He's pastored, became president of Southern Seminary, one of the largest Baptist seminaries, about 20 years ago. He served as editor of the Christian Index before he came there. In this day and time, he is making such a difference on a lot of the contemporary issues. If you haven't listened to The Briefing, a daily analysis of the news and events from a Christian perspective, it's a podcast. I encourage you to find time to do that. It will educate you and give you the tools you need to face many of the issues we see today. The Chicago Tribune said, quote, he's an articulate voice for conservative Christianity at large, end quote. It's a blessing to have him come and talk to us about right of conscience. Al, we are so concerned in healthcare about healthcare right of conscience, which really is religious freedom in healthcare. You are one of the main spokesmen in the country on this issue. I was just reading your most recent blog, and, you know, the liberals are declaring victory, and now it's time to punish those who have lost. And take us into this topic and what you're seeing right now, what you see in the future, and how we need to be involved on this issue, or is it just too late?
Well, we have to hope it's not too late in full, but we also have to learn to expect how social processes work. And there's been a massive moral revolution that's taken place. That moral revolution, like every revolution, begins to concretize and rationalize itself on the other side. So when you have a moral revolution, just for example, on the issue of LGBT issues and same-sex marriage, you're going to have a rationalization of that entire process on the other side with law, court decisions, school policies, terminology in the media. The entire social conversation will conform to this new reality. But we also need to recognize it comes with coercion, because something on this scale isn't going to be accomplished in the way that the LGBT community demands unless there is coercion. And so now we're seeing exactly what that looks like. You know, you can't talk about this without pointing to the former fire chief of Atlanta. Merely wrote a little book for members of his own Bible study in which he affirmed a traditional biblical morality. You've got conscience clause cases right now before courts dealing with pharmacists, nurses, doctors, and others. This will leave no profession untouched. It will leave no citizen untouched by the collision between what is now ensconced in our society as something that's a sexual liberty in the collision with religious liberty. It's inevitable. We're now not just seeing it hypothetically. We're seeing it every day in the headlines.
Yeah, and it's impacting our members. I was talking to a physician assistant yesterday who got disciplined in his job teaching in a school because of his views. We've had members lose their positions, and one surgeon in particular has lost hospital privileges and may lose his medical license because he spoke out on the LGBT issue in his hospital saying, why are we promoting this considering all the health consequences for patients that I'm seeing every day as urologists. If there is no truth, there is no common sense, which it's a shadow. And if there is no truth, then there is a myth that's being promoted. And the only way to get people to conform to the myth is to force them to do it. And that's what you're talking about.
Well, absolutely. You know, the biggest issue for the Christian worldview in this is not the LGB, it's the T.
Yeah.
Because the transgender revolution requires a far deeper revolution in thinking and terminology. It's a deeper crisis in terms of personal identity. And so one of the most interesting things is how the entire society is now breaking down in language. And we're having an enforced new ideology put upon public schools. I mean, the force coming from the Department of Justice to school districts saying you have to allow a biological male into a girl's changing area and restrooms. Civilization has never experienced this kind of coercive intrusion into private life at this kind of speed. It's not a pretty sight.
What do you see down the road, Al? I mean, how can we as healthcare professionals, we just came out with our transgender statement and look at the science and biblical and social and all the rest of it and trying to get that out into pastors and others' hands because, you know, the other side say we've got the science. Well, that's not true. And those of us who are scientists and deal with healthcare need to be part of the group speaking out on this issue from a biblical point of view. But what do you see ahead, and what do you advise your pastors that are now going to have their sermons examined, as one of our doctor members did, preached as a lay preacher and lost his job because they read his sermons?
Well, we're going to have to realize that it's going to cost us a great deal more to be Christians in a post-Christian society than it did in a time of normative, nominal Christianity. And, you know, let's face it, I'm old enough to remember an America in which people thought they were supposed to be Christians, even if they weren't, they were supposed to act like they were.
Yeah.
We're now in a society in which that nominal Christianity is disappearing, and instead it's being replaced with a coerced secularism, and it comes with a heavy price, and we're going to have to pay a much heavier price for conviction. And if it's true for me, I'm 56 years old, just imagine how true it is for an 18-year-old arriving on a college campus, regardless of the profession that he or she may enter. But professionals are on the front lines of where a society defines itself. That's a part of the elite function of the professions. And so whether it's law or medicine or you go down the entire list, just consider how the professional accrediting societies are beginning to enforce this new moral revolution. Mm-hmm. And whether it's the ABA or the AMA or you go down the list. And by the way, the APA in the American Psychiatric Association and its sister organization, the American Psychological Association, they were at the forefront of driving this moral revolution. Mm-hmm. And so it's an inevitable collision. Individual rights, by the way, always, whether it was the Soviet Revolution or the French Revolution, you go down the list, almost all these revolutions come with a real cost to individual liberty. We're told you simply have to get in line with the revolution. And that's the article I published this morning, because you had a professor at Harvard Law School who's saying just that the losing side in this moral revolution needs to be treated, in his words, just like Japan and Germany at the end of World War II. No accommodation.
Blows your mind, doesn't it? And we, you know, and it's so easy to sit here and think, well, but we live in a democracy. We have a constitution. This is, you know, but the bottom line reality is it's here and it doesn't seem to be going away and it's probably going to get worse. I think the good news is two things. One, we know the end of the story, Al. And secondly, this is probably going to do more to strengthen the church. It's going to get rid of the cultural Christians, and people are going to have to get deep in their faith because their convictions are going to have a price to them.
You know, it's going to be increasingly the case that the people who show up in church are the people who are going to be willing to be found there.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we're paying a price to identify with Christ and the gospel and Christ Church, then we're going to find who are the people willing to pay that price. And, you know, the power of the gospel, I believe, will be really clearly displayed in the midst of this.
Mm-hmm.
In a couple of ways. For one thing, people are still going to hear the gospel and believing they're going to be saved and their lives are going to be transformed. But the second way is this. People are going to watch Christians painfully pay a price because by conviction we can't go where the moral revolutionaries want us to go. And when they ask the question, why, the only answer is going to be commitment to the gospel of Jesus Christ. We didn't ask for this moment, but we've got to be faithful in the midst of this moment.
Yeah, yeah. And God doesn't waste suffering. We see that in our own personal lives, and we see it in history of what has happened with the church under these difficult circumstances. Al, I want to encourage people to go read your blog, and it's tremendous. And thank you for your leadership, for your critical thinking, for how you've helped take us places we need to go. And I just appreciate you doing this interview with us on a very busy day here around the time of graduation at the seminary. But God bless you. You're in our prayers, and we look forward to continuing to learn at your feet.
Well, thank you. I really have enjoyed the conversation, and I want you to know how much I appreciate what you do and how thankful I am for Christian medical doctors and dentists and others who serve the cause of Christ and serve us all so well.
Wow, wasn't that great stuff with Dr. Moeller? I encourage you to go to his website, albertmoeller.com, to listen to the briefing and Thinking in Public and the other resources he provides. They're all excellent. They're current. It's something that, you know, while you're jogging or exercising or whatever, can really educate you and equip you for these challenges that we face. You know, talking about challenges, I mean, the culture is getting darker around us. We're seeing it every day, and the attacks that are coming, I'm mindful of them more than ever. I mean, we are just bombarded with these issues. This transgender issue is just coming at us from so many different directions. And CMDA is responding, and you should know that. I mean, we now have brought a legal suit in California to try to get an injunction to halt the physician-assisted suicide that's going on there. In Vermont, the medical board in that state is trying to force doctors to participate in physician-assisted suicide. It's been legalized for a number of years. There have been very few people that have done this in that state. So the medical board has turned around and said that physician-assisted suicide should be part of the mandated end-of-life counseling in the state, and that you need to include it and talk about it and tell them how it works. And then secondly, if the patient wants it, you have to refer. Now, if you don't understand the issue of moral complicity, go to our website and pull down the ethics statement on that, and it'll help you understand when you are moral complicit in a situation. And doctors in Vermont, our members there, would be morally complicit if they facilitate a suicide of a patient by referring them to a doctor that would do it. Did you know in California, one of the doctors who's a big proponent was retired? He's just come back to practice, and his practice is only for physician-assisted suicide. He charges $2,000, and he'll help you kill yourself. You can see where all this is going. And if we don't stop this in Vermont, we're going to have the same issue in every state, in your state, as physician-assisted suicide continues to be legalized from state to state. So we brought suit, and we're trying to stop this. Now, I'm not big on legal action and suits, but there's days recently I wished I was a lawyer because I was wading through all this stuff and working with our legal representatives. But we feel it's important to stop this, and we've committed the resources to do it. And then the transgender issue. I mean, we are just bombarded with this in the last few months. Regulation after regulation coming down from the federal government and from state governments and from local school districts pushing this agenda. Not pushing it, actually requiring it and putting penalties in place if you don't participate in it. For example, the federal government now through HHS is saying that doctors and other healthcare professionals must participate in the transgender agenda. What do I mean by that? In other words, if a transgender patient comes in, a parent comes in with a child, you have to provide counseling for them, and you cannot dissuade them, according to this regulation, from moving down this path. If you give hormones to any patient, you have to provide hormones to a parent who wants them for their child who thinks they're transgender, despite the scientific fact that 80 to 95% of these children, once they go through adolescence, settle into their own sex and gender without any type of conflict. But no, let's give them these hormones and delay puberty so transition surgery will be easier. For the transition, if you're in a surgical specialty, OBGYN or surgery, my goodness, you have to participate in the transition. In fact, if you provide a procedure for anybody, you must provide it for a transgender patient on demand. So if a woman comes in and says, I think I'm a man, I want a mastectomy, you have to do it. I want a hysterectomy, you've got to do it. You're a urologist and they want a orchiectomy, you've got to do it. Even dentists are going to be affected by this, I believe, because in Colorado, in Denver, there's a dental practice that specializes in doing dental procedures to help you change the look of your face from male to female or female to male. So even the dentist may not escape from this. What's the penalty? Well, this just isn't an encouragement. You'll lose all Medicare and Medicaid funding if you violate these regulations. Your hospital will lose all Medicare and Medicaid funding. They're bringing out the biggest club possible to force this change. Does it stop there? No, we're dealing with Virginia and Florida and other states that are contacting us daily. Pro-life groups saying our state's trying to force this into the schools, or our states are trying to force this into the Department of Families and Adolescents, and they're seeing it all over the place. And can you help us? Can you provide expert testimony? Can you give us written testimony? We're trying to fight this issue. This is a delusion, as we've heard on this CDD, but also transitions are actually harmful. Long-term studies out of Sweden, where this is very well accepted, it shows the suicide rate goes up 20-fold by 10 years after getting a transition surgery. So we need to speak out on this medically. We need to speak out on this ethically. We need to speak out on this from a Christian point of view. And that's what CMDA is doing in your behalf. I know how busy you are, but we have to speak out now. We need to try to hold back this tide and use our influence as the largest pro-life medical association in the country, as a group that believes in right of conscience, as a group that stands for Christian principles. We're the main group, and everybody's coming to us. So we need your help. First of all, I need your prayers. I like you, I get weary in well-doing, and it's been that way in these last few months for all of our staff, because we have much more work than we can handle, and many more people begging us to help them in their situation in their local area. Secondly, you may want to give some extra money financially, and that's not the main point of what I'm saying, but the bottom line, and it's true, is we need more staff to address this. I mean, I'm working in it part-time, with all my other duties as the CEO. Our communications director handles all our communications. She's trying to handle the state issues as well, and then John Imbody in Washington, the federal issues. That's not enough for all the issues that we're facing. So I encourage you, not only give more, but find other people to join CMDA. The benefit of that is, not only is it a little extra income, but more importantly, we have more people that we're representing, and we have more clout in the marketplace, in the legislatures, in the media, and also in the courts. So talk to your friends and say, hey, are you concerned about these issues? Here's the group that's speaking out. You need to be part of CMDA, or it's going to affect you and your practice. I want to say one other thing as we close, and just be bluntly honest with you. I think in the long run, we're going to lose a lot of these issues. Am I discouraged about that? No, but just looking at trends, God could surprise us. God could intervene. We may be able to lay it for a significant amount of time. But as you watch what's happening with the culture and what is believed about religious freedom by many groups now, that it doesn't exist and people need to be forced to do this, I'm not optimistic. And so I want to speak to that. We need to get prepared, because I think we're going to face more and more issues and literally persecution. We're seeing that with more and more of our members. And we need to be prepared in our hearts and in our minds to realize this is coming. Just as Paul wrote to the Christians in the epistles and saying persecution is coming, or persecution has arrived, you have hope. And I need to say that to you, and that's what Christ wants to say to you, that our joy is not based upon whether we win these battles or not. I'm a very competitive person. Ask my wife, she'll tell you that. I've always been very competitive, and it's very easy to say, I've got to win this battle. I've got to find the perfect argument, the perfect soundbite, the perfect legal brief that's going to make this happen. But my job is not to win. My job is to be faithful, and that's your job as well. And even if we lose these battles, what an opportunity God's going to give us to be voices of righteousness into our culture, to show peace in the midst of the persecution that's going to come. Our lights are going to shine brightest in the midst of the darkness. in the midst of the persecution. That's when God grows his church. It's when he separates the sheep from the goats, is during these times. And it's going to strengthen church. And we need to anticipate that and embrace it as it comes, not as a terrible burden, but as a badge of honor that God has asked us to bear in his behalf, to show him to people. We often get our greatest attention during the times when things are most difficult. I've seen that as I've worked overseas in areas where persecution of Christians is very common, and we're increasingly see it here in this country. So dig into your Bible, claim those verses, claim those promises of God, that he will be with us, that he is enough no matter what comes. And then we know the end of the story. We know the end of the story. Yes, God promised that there would be difficult days, and he promised he would be sufficient, and he promised that when it's all done, we're going to win. Well, listen, till we have an opportunity to get together again, pray for us. We're here working for you every day, and we want to serve you. If you have needs, let us know. We are honored to be your representatives here at CMDA in this culture, and as we bring on the next generation of Christian doctors and in missions around the world, we are honored to work for you. Pray for us, because that's the key to power. That's the key to success. That is the key to being faithful. We need your prayers. Till we have a chance to talk again, may God bless you in the days ahead.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctors Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.